Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench.
Hello, welcome back to Fighting on Film. Now, last week we were talking about the SAG-AFTRA strike, which is still going on. Our thoughts are with everyone that is still striking. However, we are back to reviewing war films like we do.
We definitely do that.
And this week, we genuinely couldn't decide on a movie. So This isn't the Patreon pick, but this is more of a sort of like grand Twitter pick where we just put four movies up on the Twitter page.
At Fighting on Film, if you're not following already.
Yeah, and by the time this goes out, it's probably called X, whatever's going on there.
Ugh, dumb.
And there were four films to choose, and U571 came out top trumps with 59% of the vote. So without further ado, let's dive into the production.
Let's
do it. So I'm on production this week, and the film was directed by John Mostow, whose credits include 1997's Breakdown, that starred Kurt Russell, Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines in 2003, which I found out that he was paid $5 million to do. Amazing. And then most recently, a film called The Hunters in 2017 that starred Sam Worthington, and he's also directed a couple of episodes of the US version of The Accused this year.
Oh.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that.
No. The film was co-written by Mostow and Sam Montgomery, who wrote Breakdown, and later four episodes of 24. However, the last writer of the film, in his first credit, no doubt, is probably the biggest name out of everyone who was involved in the movie, probably in terms of directing and writing. David Ayer.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. David Ayer, who obviously around here, in war movie terms, we know him of the writer and director of Fury in 2014. His other works include Sabotage, Suicide Squad, and writing Training Day, which came out in 2001. So very talented writer and director.
Very interesting. Competent.
That he cut his teeth on this, and we'll hear more from him later in the same segment. But the film was produced by Dino De Laurentiis and his daughter. As you remember from the Anzio episode, big famous Italian producer, along with Studio Canal. It's distributed by Universal Pictures in the United States and Summit Entertainment overseas. And the budget was $62 million, and the gross was $127 million. So I think it was a bit of a success. Reports at the time. Do say the film made a healthy profit. So the cinematography was by the late Oliver Wood. He broke through working as the director of photography on Miami Vice in the 80s. and doing over 50 episodes. Then he broke through into features and just a few of his credits, Die Hard 2, Sister Act 2, Face Off, The Bourne Trilogy, which was BAFTA nominated for Best Cinematography on the final Bourne film in 2007. And his final credit before he died in February of this year was Morbius in 2022. So quite a big career. Sound was by Richard Marvin, whose other credits include 2009 Surrogate, that weird Bruce Willis film that I remember watching.
Where they're all in like chairs at home and there's like a mechanical version of them goes out and lives their lives.
Isn't it?
I've seen it. It wasn't that
bad. I've seen it too. It was a stalwart of Sky Movies back in the day.
It was. That's very true.
Sky Movies action. It was always on it. And then he also did Disney's Balloon Farm, which had Rip Torn in it. Currently
I've not seen
Sanders,
that.
So I had to mention Rip Torn.
Sounds fantastic.
It's interesting. One of Disney's straight to TV films, I think. But it was actually the film U571 film was nominated for 2 Oscars. Incredibly. Nominated for Best Sound and Best Sound Editing, and it won Best Sound, but it lost out to Sound Editing to Gladiator. So it was quite a feat. Filmed in Malta in Italy, using many practical effects. Like, this is a thing I was watching the making of little shorts that come on the DVD. And you know, they really go hard on this is an effects led film. So they built a full size replica U-boat. It was diesel powered. It weighed 600 tons, and the replica, which is called the S-33, because it's meant to be an American sub that's been doctored to look like a U-boat. But it is just a U-boat. They don't really make it look like it's been doctored. It's just a U-boat replica.
It does look like it is just a U-boat, yeah.
Yeah. And I saw it, actually, when I went to Malta on holiday in 2008, and it looked pretty banged up then. It was just in a dry dock. Apparently it's been recently used in the Das Boot series, and it was in France and I think it got repaired, and then it was brought back to Malta when they filmed a bit of Das Boot there. So it's still going. And they shot the interior sequences for U571 on the largest soundstage in Europe at the time. They made replica sets of the inside of U-boat that were full sized, and they put them on a gimbal. So when the U-boats, you know, rocking about, they actually were being thrown around on this gimbal.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's pretty
nice.
Cool. Yeah.
And then the exterior shots, like at sea shots, I guess, if you will, were shot in a massive open water tank. So everything is as real as they can make it. And Bill Paxton commented at the time that they used the biggest rain towers apparently ever used in a movie at the time. So that's a feat, I guess.
There is a lot of rain.
A lot of rain. It was released in the US on April the 17th, 2000, and in the UK on June the 2nd. David Kahn...
with rave reviews.
Oh, yeah, don't worry. We're getting to the controversy, folks.
Loved
it. I'm building it, but I'm trying to set the scene of you know, they were...
You're doing a grand job.
They were trying to, like, make a movie here, guys. Like, the controversy came after the film started into motion, and so that's why it comes in the second part of production. Don't worry. So, Dr. David Kahn, a historian who wrote books on cracking Enigma codes, and retired Royal Navy Lieutenant Commander David Baum served as the film's historical and technical advisor. And Baum himself was the man who captured the real, genuine Enigma machine from U-110 in May 1941. And the Italian Navy were also consulted during filming. So this is where the controversy starts. So this is a quote from Mostow during the production, and him saying how he wants the film to be done. So he says, "The sad truth is that many young people today, in 2000, have no idea what occurred in World War II, much less the Battle of the Atlantic. It's my sincere hope that people will see U-571 and be motivated to learn more about the real-life heroes who fought to preserve world freedom." Fair enough. You know, but
you thought it would have been great though if the actual film had been about the real heroes.
Exactly right. Exactly. So I'll go on.
The big old open goal, mister.
Massive, right? Yeah. Much like, and I've got written down here, much like Objective Burma in 1945, was very controversial over here in the UK at the time of release. Obviously, the plot, as I mentioned, the plot's taken from the story of HMS Bulldog capturing an intact Enigma machine, and then Baum himself obviously doing it. And he found what he called a funny looking typewriter, so he took it off the boat. You know, if he hadn't had thought of mind at the time to take this odd looking machine. We may not
and the cipher books as well.
Exactly, in the cipher books. So the BBC reported in May 1999 that a petition had been championed by Baum and signed by more than 70 members of parliament to include reference to the British actions that recovered the Enigma machine in 1941. Baum's quoted as saying, "They're going to put full credits at the end of the film about the real events. They were very sorry they had upset the British, and they are trying to put it right. I'm glad the British will get the credit we deserve." And he was given a walk-on role in the film. I don't know when he appears, but apparently he has a walk-on role. Maybe it's in the scene at the start with the party. That probably seems like the most logical place to put him in.
Seems logical, yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't find him in the credits to have that walk-on role, but I'm sure it's in there. Anyway, so David Ayer spoke in 2006, reflecting on the controversy during an episode of the film programme on BBC Radio 4. He said, "I did not feel good about it. It was a distortion, a mercenary decision to create this parallel history in order to drive the movie for American audiences. Both my grandparents were officers in World War II, and I'd be personally offended if somebody distorted their achievements. I met with Royal Navy officer who actually went down into the U-boat and recovered the Enigma machine in 1941. He seemed okay with it. He was a great guy, but I understand how important that event is to the UK, and I won't do it again." Fair enough.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And then even more so, so that the film, it goes on and the film comes out, and then in the week of release in the UK, it gets brought up in Prime Minister's Question Times. I don't think this has ever happened before or since about a war film.
I can't think of another occasion when it has, no.
No. So Empire magazine reported on this, and it was from, I think, the 8th of June 2000. It says, "Tony Blair's now waded into the affair by saying he entirely agreed with fellow MP's comments that the film was an affront to the British Navy and war veterans, commenting that the film's depiction of an American rather than a British crew capturing a crucial Enigma machine during the war. He said, "We hope that people realise that there are people that in many cases sacrifice their lives in order that this country remain free." Culture Secretary Chris Smith, who has pledged to raise the thorny issue in Hollywood, commented on the furore earlier, saying, "I think one of the things we need to make clear to Hollywood is, yes, if you're in the entertainment business, but people see your movies, they're going to come away thinking that information is not just entertainment." Thinking that's information, not entertainment. So, like, you know, what we say on the show, you've got to be really careful. If your movie's about real events, make sure you tell people.
Yeah.
Because it's important. And there's even more on this that I didn't really... I read, but I'm not going to read out because it'll be here forever. But there was a thing in the stage where it was saying, like, well, if America's going to do this, then they really should reflect their own military history. You know, they should really talk about their invasion to Panama and Cuba, things like that. You know, saying there's a lot more controversy around their own military history at the time. So maybe they should go into that and not keep, you know, cherry picking our history out of there. Quite a bit of an attack job there. So this is reflected, I think, in the reviews as well. So I've chosen two reviews this week. Production's a long one this week, I know, but just thought it's interesting to get all the controversy out of the way before we look at this movie as a movie. Maybe we'll come back to controversies in final thoughts, but just thought it was interesting to get the discussion going. Roger Ebert, good old trusty Roger Ebert, is first, and these are both from the time of release in their respective countries. So he says, "You can enjoy U-571 as a big, dumb war movie without a brain in its head, but that doesn't stop it from looking cheesy. Producers Adino and Martha Laurentiis and director Jonathan Mostow have counted on a fast action to distract from the plausibility of most of the scenes at sea, especially the shots of the raft boarding party. Inside the sub, they have usual cliché: the sub dives beyond its rated depth, metal plates creak and bolt heads come loose under pressure." And then he ends by basically saying, "It can't be blamed for one story element that's standard in all sub-movies. The subs can be hammered, battered, shelled, depth-bombed and squeezed by pressure, have leaks, fires, shattered gauges, ruptures, broken hoses, weak batteries and irreparable diesel engines. But in the height of the action, everything more or less somehow works, much better than the screenplay at least."
Yeah, I mean, the submarine does miraculously manage to still work by the end of the film. But
it's incorrect, yeah.
I feel like that's a little bit generous. In places there.
Yeah.
Like the scene where they're going across to the U-boat isn't that cheesy. Fine. It's not unbelievable.
It works. It's fine. Yeah. Anyway, so George Perry of the BBC writes, Controversy surrounds this submarine action film because Hollywood's rewritten history again. You can see the reasoning. Turning it into an American exploit makes for better box office. If U-571 had been good, this would have been forgivable. Alas, it's a noisy, cliche-ridden, incomprehensible mess. Matthew McConaughey, shaven-headed and sunken-cheeked, plays a young officer denied command till he's proved himself. He's given a mission to capture a U-boat by pretending to be a German supply crew. It's one of those silly films where massive assaults from enemy torpedoes and depth charges always miss, but one hastily American shot can produce a miniature nuclear explosion. Good actors like Bill Paxton, Harvey Keitel struggle with cardboard characters, and action sequences are chaotic with eardrum-bursting sound effects. The best U-boat film for me was Das Boot. This comparison is a travesty.
That is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it?
Because the production designer on U-571 was Gotz Winder, or Winder, who was the production designer on Das Boot.
Exactly.
And yep. Those interior scenes, you know, when they're on the U-boat, that you can see good. You can see the similarities. Yep. So you can see he's gone for a similar sort of production design. But yeah, it doesn't really stand up to Das Boot.
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, I at the start, I mean, if you view that sequence at the start on the U-boat, where they're just chaps on a U-boat and you have no idea what's going on, and it just plonks you right in there, yeah. In their, whatever it's called, the cockpit of a submarine, I don't bloody know, I'm a landlubber.
The viewing room.
Viewing room, yeah, that's a little in joke there for me and Matt. Anyway, they're in that little command bit where the periscope is, and yeah. All the Navy people are going to be screaming at their speakers.
Bridge?
The bridge, Matt? I don't know.
I honestly don't
know. The bit underneath the conning tower where they all...
Yeah, the control room.
Driving. We're,
yeah.
You know,
we're not
sailing.
Anyway,
that bit is very reminiscent of Das Boot. You could cut that in to
And I love that as a cold opening. I think that works really well.
Yeah, it works really well. Yeah, I agree. Anyway, what did you guys think? We have the one-word review back after a couple of weeks off. And it was another bumper crop. We had 88 or 90, nearly 100 replies, something silly like that.
Everyone loved it.
Yeah,
everyone loved it.
No controversy.
No need to read
them
all, Rob. We all know that everyone loved it.
Exactly. Moving on, we have to say a few of these. So, and these are in no particular order. So Alan Taylor goes with shite. The Unconventional Soldier podcast goes with dive. Sari Thomas goes with awesome with crying emojis. Kevin Getz puts the alarm emoji from Das Boot and goes, because it's that bad. David Berber goes, crap. R. Burgos goes, purportedly, which I quite like. Nick Lahari goes with balderdash. A.D. Bond goes with why. Brian Williams goes with bollocks. A Few Minutes for History says American. Ken, it's all connected, so it is one word. It goes, all right, all right, all right. Ian Kikuchi goes with ballast, and Chris Ayres, to finish us off, says poppycock.
There's a consensus there somewhere.
There is, yeah. And I'll talk about this at the end, but I think this is probably one of the few films that we'll do on the show that its controversy really precedes it. Mm-hmm. Almost it to the fact that it is above the film. Like the film is seen as the afterthought in this regard. Because the controversy is so big.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. But no, that's your production. I think they set out to make, I mean, all the things that you see, like Dino De Laurentiis and Mostow, they're really saying that they want to make this big bombastic submarine film. And Dino was saying, there hasn't been a movie like this or done this way since Das Boot in terms of submarines, things like that. So they are trying to make something really grand.
Yeah.
I think it's their method of getting the story together that I think falls apart.
Yeah, I think the story is the weakest part of the film.
Yeah.
For sure.
Anyway, moving on
to
cast.
I think that takes us to cast, doesn't it?
Mm.
All right. So we start with Matthew McConaughey as Lieutenant Andrew Tyler. And this is McConaughey in his ascendance, really, isn't it? Late 90s, yeah. Mid 2000s, McConaughey is, you know, box office. So we've got Reign of Fire in 2002. He's the only man that can do a dragon film and it not kill his career.
True. Yeah. We'll just do a load of like comedies, like romantic comedies.
Really, really weird rom-coms. Like, yeah. if he'd done, he would have really maxed it out here, but if he'd done like a rom-com with dragons, that would have been peak. Peak early 2000s.
Yeah, it would have been,
Tropic Thunder, 2008. Free State of Jones in 2016. And apparently, this is something I read on IMDb, so take this with a pinch of salt. Apparently, Michael Douglas was linked to the role, which would have been wild, because Michael Douglas was in his like late 50s in 2000.
I mean, Keitel's 61 at time of shooting. So
True. speaking of, we got Harvey Keitel. He plays Chief Gunner's mate, Henry Claw.
Claw.
He plays Chief Gunner's mate, Henry Claw. And of course, some of the military films that, Harvey's been in include The Duelists in 1977, which is an incredible film, The Grey Zone in 2001, and Taking Sides in the same year.
Don't forget the Direct Line adverts over here.
And of course, Direct Line adverts.
So funny.
And a whole range of other amazing films.
Tons.
He's a brilliant actor. And he's criminally underused in this, I think. Then we've got Bill Paxton playing Lieutenant Commander Mike Dahlgren. And Paxton is known for his role in Aliens, Navy SEALs, which we covered on the show, Resistance in 2003, Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is currently doing the rounds on Mission Impossible. He plays one of those films. Let's see if the AI picks up on that and throws some ad revenue our way. Then we've got Commando, 1985. He has like a little role in that as one of the...
Yeah. Oh, hang on, let me stop you. The amount of people that told me last week when we were saying that we weren't going to cover Oppenheimer because of the strikes, and the amount of people that contacted me going, you do know I was listening to your show and whatever you hosted your show on was giving me Oppenheimer ads. I just thought that's an irony of that. Sorry.
For once, the irony. This is why I mentioned Mission Impossible, to see if it happens. Because we obviously mentioned Oppenheimer.
Tom Cruise is back with a new Mission Impossible in cinemas now. you can just hear it, can't you?
Just right in the middle of me discussing John Bon Jovi.
Christ.
John Bon Jovi's in this movie.
For about 10 minutes.
it's 10 weird. Minutes. It's a weird one. He plays Lieutenant Pete Emmett. This is his only real war movie credit. He was in a band or something.
He was a rocker back in the day. Was our job.
And then we've got David Keith as Major Matthew Coonan, who is the specialist who comes aboard to lead the team that's going to snatch the Enigma.
Yeah, who has one scene then vanishes.
Yeah, like he comes in and you feel like he's going to be a lead, but he...
No, he's got real lead energy about him.
Yeah.
He's really charismatic, and then he's done. Yeah.
Yeah. This is his first military film since this one. He did Behind Enemy Lines with Owen Wilson in 2001.
Officer and a Gentleman, don't forget that.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? That's a war film? It's a film with military
It's themes. Military-ish, isn't it? I think he was also in like... one of those like, military academy movies as well.
Well, you're on cast, so like it was down to you to find that out.
I didn't think anyone would care, to be honest.
No, Rob. I know. Yeah, I get it. I'm with you.
Then we got Jake Weber, who plays Lieutenant Michael Hirsch. His films include Thank You for Your Service in 2017, and he was Admiral Spruance in Midway in 2019 as well.
Okay.
Very successful TV and film actor.
From
a few
episodes I've seen of it,
Jack Noseworthy plays Seaman Bill Wentz. Tom Gurry plays Seaman Trigger Fitzgerald, and he was also in Tigerland in 2000 and Black Hawk Down in 2001. Yeah, we should do both of those. They're both pretty good films.
Yeah.
Then we've got Will Estes as Torpedoman Ronald Rabbit Parker. And then we have T.C. Carson, who played Seaman Eddie Carson, who I found this fascinating. He often voices Mace Windu in Star Wars cartoons and video games.
Yeah. Wow. The
and he's
cook.
Great in this film. The cook. The few little scenes he has in this are really good.
Yeah, I wanted more of him. And I think this is the issue with the movie as well, is that I felt like they'd given those guys nicknames who weren't recognizable actors. because they were just very interchangeable people. They were like Star Trek Upper Deck people. Yeah. You know, like they have to just press a button.
Yeah, they're red shirts.
Yeah, you know, give Spock a cup of tea or something. You know, that's their job. Yeah.
Then we've got Eric Palladino, who plays Seaman Anthony Mazzola. He was in Over There in 2005, which was a short-lived HBO series about the invasion of Iraq, I believe.
Oh, in 2003.
David Power plays machinist Charles Tank Clemens. Derek Chetwood plays Seaman Herb Griggs. Matthew Settle plays Ensign Keith Larson, who is probably best known for playing Major Spears in Band of Brothers. But not a huge role in this, so looking missing.
Yeah.
And then I think the chap with the most absolutely fascinating career is Thomas Ketchman, who plays the sub-captain. And his military movies include Warrior's Heart, which is a Norwegian film about the Winter War in 92, Stalingrad in 93, The Pianist in 2002, Downfall in 2004, He played Eichmann in Eichmann in the same year.
Incredible.
He was in Valkyrie in 2008 with Tom Cruise, who has just released the latest Mission Impossible film.
The latest Hollywood blockbuster is coming this summer.
And then he was in Stalingrad 2013.
Yeah.
Das Boot 2020 made an appearance there. And I love this. He was the voice of the U-boat captain in Greyhound.
Yeah.
What a brilliant cameo. And then
Greyhound. We are Andanisio. In that weird, weird bit.
Worked hard on that one, didn't he?
Yeah, I know, right? Fire in the booth, recording booth, literally.
And then most recently, he was Colonel Weber in Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, which was recently in cinemas.
We love an actor who can't push that one. Turn down a war movie role. We love it. Yeah, we love to see
exactly.
it. Yeah,
we won't push that one too hard because I think it's finished its run, so we probably won't get any ads for that.
No, probably not.
And that rounds our cast. It's not a bad cast. I will say this now: it's not a bad cast. It's got some great actors: Paxton Keitel, Keith McConaughey, and a lot of the
horrendously cast. late '90s, early 2000s cast. There,
yeah, totally. They're all solid.
Yeah, Oscar winners as well because of McConaughey.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. The cast isn't the issue with the movie for me, but we'll talk about that more later. So maybe we should dust off the Alitalia. It's been a few weeks, Matt.
It has. And we've got some good stuff this week.
We do. We really, really.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
It's time for Alitalia on Fighting on Film.
Matt, kick us off. What you got?
Harvey Keitel with a 1911 in a shoulder rig. Doesn't get better than that. Doesn't get better than
with
that.
With the chunky knit.
With the chunky blue jumper. Carrying
it's a look.
A Thompson with a folding stock.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Mad.
I had to this pause film, the movie. I was like, what's are they in one car by para stocks? I was like, what's going on?
Totally.
There's
are.
A picture wow. I found on INFDB, the firearms database, of one with the stock fully out. And I was like, if the length of pull on a Thompson was not already shocking. Like, you've made that 10 times worse for the user. And they don't even extend the stocks.
No, they don't. They don't. Like, and my favorite thing is they could have just taken the stock off of Thompson and just had the Thompson. Clearly, that would have made complete sense because they're 1928s. So all, you know, entirely possible. There's one M1 in there.
It's right for that time of the war, which I like.
It is. It is. And it's so weird because they clear that sub and there's a lot of that, like, pointing downwards with the Tommy gun kind of like just blasting.
I like that. You know, it's very commando blasting. Book style shooting. I do like it.
It is. McConaughey is running around like with a modern two-handed grip on that 1911.
Beautiful.
And I'm like, no, don't do that, Matthew. That's
I really
quite
like
right.
him in that sequence because he's the only one that sells that they've
he
never
reloads
been
as
in.
Well.
Yeah, but he really sells the fact they've not been in combat and they're probably very lightly weapon
very
trained.
True.
He really sells it. No one else does.
Like, it's amazing that so many of that boarding party survived, to be honest.
We're Navy men, sir. We're not combat Marines. And I'm like, well, you're fucking right you are. And then Coonan, the guy, goes, don't worry, I'll train you. We never get to see any of that training.
No.
I was like, just show me a quick sequence of them on the deck of the U-boat in open sea.
I want
sea.
To see Harvey Keitel learning how to put a magazine in a Thompson.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's the only one that I would think that would know it because he's meant to be from the First World War as well. So
I love his. Well, he's never seen a Thompson roll. He's seen them in films.
Maybe not.
He's never been.
Oh, I thought you meant a pistol. Sorry, I was like, he might have been pistol trained.
Oh yeah, he'd be pistol trained.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely. He's probably spent some time with the 1903 Springfield, but he's never had a Thompson.
I just wanted to see a little sequence of them doing some target practice on the top of the U-boat. That'd have been enough for me.
Yeah, with Bill Paxton like watching on. Like,
yeah, just to sell that these guys can do it, because when they do get on the U-boat, I suspended my belief a minute when they're like this really cool raiding party. We'll talk about that in a minute. But yeah, like that, the inclusion, the little folding stock Thompson.
Never seen anything
quite
like that before.
No, me neither. But it's good because even though the movie is fiction, complete fiction, they've done little things there to, you know, give a little bit more spice to it. I really liked seeing Major Coonan's rising M55 submachine gun. Rare as Rocking Horse in any war movie.
Very.
I did some research.
Talk about a useless folding stock, but yeah.
I know, yeah, right? It's just like a little wire frame thing.
Yes. I've had coat hangers that look more steady than that.
It literally is a coat hanger type stock on that. So the last time we mentioned risings on the pod was way back when we covered Go for Broke. When there was a rising that's like mocked up to like an MP40. Remember that?
Yeah.
But there are only risings in a few war movies. The only one of note that I can think of that people might have seen was Guadalcanal Diary. That has risings in it. They were used by the US Marine Corps over the Thompson at the time. They're just rare to see in a film. So they're like the wooden, big wooden furniture on it, if you're not sure what we're talking about, if you've seen the movie. But they're really nice to see. And Coonan's got these little mag pouches. That are like made of webbing.
With the Rising's amazing 15-round magazine.
Perfect. And he fires it. He does fire a big burst at one Jerry with it. I like to see it. I liked the bit where he, quite alley move, where they were trying to get down into the submarine, and he like pulls the pin on that M1 grenade and cooks it, and he goes like, 2, 3, 4, and he throws it down. He's like, shut it. And then you get an explosion. It's a really deafening thud.
That's good.
And that's really cool bit of dialogue, because he doesn't count. He counts the one as pulling the pin, which is really cool. And then when they go down into the sub, and not many movies do this, the frag grenade hasn't gone off like a nuclear explosion. It's just this little puff of smoke down there after the explosion, and there's men have clearly been hit by bits of shrapnel and stuff. But it felt real, like throwing that grenade felt proper. Very rare that happens. But yeah, I think that is the most of the alley in the movie. There's some deck guns going on.
Yeah, there's an Oerlikon and there's another flat gun.
I'm pretty sure
there's some MP40s.
Yeah,
there's a Walther P38 that I think. There's a dude as they're clearing the boat. There's a dude that's lying on his bunk, and he's like aiming through, and they open a curtain and they light him up.
Absolutely cool of that, like, didn't they?
There's another guy with one right at the back of the boat. Where he's made himself a little barricade out of mattresses, which I thought was cool, and then he fails to drop anyone as they silhouette through the doorway.
They're coming out of one. There's one way in and one way out.
My guy, you had them banged to rights on that doorway.
Target rich environment. He was a baddie, so he had to die. You know,
MG34.
That was nice. I mean, thank God that belt was full of blank. All those men in that boat would have got really hurt.
I know. Those poor seamen surviving the convoy.
I know, right?
At the beginning there. Oh,
we just had to make sure the Germans
blank saved
baddies.
Lives.
They were their baddies in this, man.
Yeah, I wonder if that ever happened, anything like that. I did try to search it and I couldn't see
remember.
Any.
I think direct reference I've been to told something that that's happened, like that. I want to say, but I don't know.
It's one thing to like leave them behind. It's quite another to like machine gun the lifeboat.
It's a bit much. They could just sailed off. There's not much they could have done. You know.
Yeah, you needed to know that Thomas Kirchman's like, captain was a real shit.
A bit of dialogue which would have been a bit colder, would have been more evil if he had just gone dive now, like they're not coming aboard, dive, and then he could just say, you know, let the buzzards have, or the seagulls have them or something, you know, or let the sea have them.
I suppose, you know, they're struggling because they're damaged, aren't they, so they can't dive. There's reasoning to it, but it was weird.
Pushing them away a little bit. No.
I'm sure if you fired like a burst in front of them, they would have gone, okay, no worries.
Away. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anyway.
The plane was an Italian Fiat G59.
Yeah, someone, I think, was it Nick Lahari, one of our listeners, who mentioned him in the one with reviews. He mentioned that it's a single engine reconnaissance plane. And I was like, well, maybe they shot it out of a catapult on the ship. They had them.
I don't know
if the Germans had them, but don't we had some stuff like that?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. The ship was the Italian tug, the ITS Proteo.
Yeah, it was definitely modern. Some of the shots that not really
stood in for
well.
The German destroyer, which I'm like, oh,
destroyer.
Well, my favorite line of the whole film, Rob, was, oh my God, we're going to have to go through, you know, the channel, which is full of German boats and ships, and I'm like, what the fuck? No,
how?
No,
where
it
the
really
fuck
isn't.
Are you? Yeah,
like, you have to go into like the Bay of Biscay or something. I'm like,
exactly.
Yeah.
So the thing is, this movie works if you set it in like Italy or the Med at that time. Like, I can believe German ships would be running around the Med, you know. Or
I'm gonna go with it's an alternate reality. That's why they have the weird foldy Thompsons.
Okay. Yeah,
and the Bay of Biscay and the Channel are absolutely full of German ships.
Yeah, swarming. Can't move from.
And that's why, you know, the Royal Navy never captured an Enigma in 1941, full 6 months before this film's set.
I love how none of those people have been up against U-boats before. None of those people have been up against the German Navy before, that have us believe. Yet Matthew McConaughey knows what a German destroyer looks like on the horizon in like 2 seconds. I just love writing like that.
He's been over the recognition guides, Rob.
Yeah, yeah. I love all their random fucking propaganda that they had up in their little chow, like mess hall in the U-boat.
Oh, yeah. And the Beck's beer bottles in the cabinet as well.
It's so funny to me. Yeah. Anyway, moving on from... But yeah, good alley this week, actually. I must admit, I did enjoy it. Moving on to favourite scenes.
Hello there, sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show.
Rob, what was your favourite scene this week?
My favourite scene is the taking of U571. The sequence, that little...
I thought you were going to say Pelham 123 then.
That's a better film. great film. Love that film. Anyway. No, it's the bit where they transfer from the U-boat that's not a U-boat into the U-571, and they're trying to, like... They've got the one guy that can speak German right at the front, and he's been like, I've got this bag full of porn for you. And they're like...
The dialogue in that is wild, because
really
he's there,
clunky.
He's like... Like McConaughey's like jabbing him in the side with a Tommy gun and saying, you sent him the talk, speak. And Hershey's like clammed up. And it takes the crew member who has a really great scene where he owns
Wentz,
Weber's character. Seaman Wentz, where he's like, I study German at Brown University.
Yeah, so fuck you,
like,
mate.
Well, why aren't you in the intelligence corps, my guy?
Yeah, no, right. You'd have been nabbed the minute you'd have signed up.
Right. What did you do not to get picked up for office, like officer training? What's gone on?
But he finally does say something,
and then he really like leans into
it.
We've got like a bag here full of like letters with the smell of French hookers perfume, and he's like, he fakes like throwing it into the sea, yeah, and everyone on the U-boat like, no,
and they're going, oh, we're mechanics, and
we're all mechanics. We'll have you up and running in no time.
And then one guy thinks it's a great idea to like unsheath the Tommy gun before they're even on the deck. So I like that though
because that proves that they really are not hardened combat marines.
No, exactly, and it does do that. And then they all sort of clamber on the U-boat and they start shooting. Yeah. And you got Coonan's clearly trying to lead them. He's like Conningtower, and you know, some like, you know, sort of commando book type shooting. A lot of point shooting. Love it. Like all guns blazing. And there's, as I mentioned, the Alitalia, you've got the call sequence of them getting into the U-boat from the conning tower, and the German crews being like, you know, dive, drown them. And it's very tense, very frantic tense. You can, some actors sell it better than others, but you can tell that they're inexperienced. I mean, obviously I think, you know, you could pick up a Thompson and point it at someone and pull the trigger. I guess that's not that hard to do in a fight or flight situation. I buy it. And then once they're in the sub, it becomes like CQB in a sub, which I've never seen before in any other movie.
Quite cool.
It's really nice. You know, so the German crew arm themselves with crew
reminded
weapons.
Me of that Medal of Honor level.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Where you infiltrate the U-boat.
Yeah, there's a level in one of the new Wolfenstein games that is set in a big German super sub, which is a little bit like that. That's cool. It's really loud, frantic. You've got McConaughey room clearing with his M1911 being really like panicky and heavy breathing, not knowing what he's doing. And I just kind of wish there was more of it. Like I would have loved it if half the sub they controlled so they could sail it, but then the other half was sort of still occupied by the Germans. And you had like, instead of having can we get the engines running? Can we take the whole sub? Which would have been a more interesting thing, but obviously harder to film, and you know, logistically, how would that work and all that. But anyway, I just wanted more of that sequence because I thought it was really well shot and handled.
Mm.
Enjoyable is the word.
Yeah.
What about you?
I like the scene with Keitel where he gives McConaughey's character advice on how to lead.
Oh yeah. That's good. That's the only character development you get in the entire movie.
Scene where Harvey Keitel gets anything to do, and that's why I liked it.
Yeah. It's great.
There's like one bit where he like chastises some sailors about, you know, not wanting to follow McConaughey's lead, which does not make sense at all because his character is set up to be well liked by the crew and respected.
Yeah, and then they all turn their minds,
and then
they all have their minds turned by nothing like 20 minutes later. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like if he had fucked up during that battle, there might be a reason, but he doesn't fuck up.
No.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, anyway, but yeah, I like that scene with Keitel. I think that worked really nicely. He basically just says, you can't say I don't know. You have to leave.
Sell it. That's good.
And that was a good scene.
I like it. It's the only character development you get as well. Which is decent. But yeah, and maybe final thoughts might be longer this week than favourite scenes. Mm. So should we schmooze in like we do?
Let's slide in.
I think, as I said earlier, like the movie, the controversy around this movie and the plot beats and the actual operation that they cherry picked information from to make their fiction guns, and to quote the director, a Guns of Navarone type action film with a bunch of, you know, stars as the main leads. It precedes the movie too much for me. So whenever you look up U571, you'll have a plethora of news articles, or, you know, that there's more, put it this way, there's on the Wikipedia about this movie, there's more about the historical issues than there is about the actual movie in the making of.
Yeah, it is infamous for it.
Infamous for it, yeah. And you've obviously got the stuff about it coming up in the UK Parliament and things like that. And they only seem to want to credit the British once they've been caught. Maybe then they're not going to do it. That's another thing that I kind of dug into a little bit. Couldn't work out whether the intention always was we're going to sort of frame this as an American thing and not. But as a film, which is ostensibly what we're talking about today, the film's just okay. Like, I don't hate it. I don't love it. It's 2 hours. I think it really stretches its runtime towards the end.
Yeah, it does drag a little.
Yeah, there's too many shots of guys clinging on to the sides of the Uber going, oh, the depth charges. Like, I've seen it. I've seen it 20 minutes ago. I don't need more of it. Like, it went on too long, and the tension that you build from trying to escape from the destroyer is lost because it goes on too long. And there's so much going on that trying to raise the stakes, and the stakes they're not staking because there's so much going on. I'm like, well, he's going to be fine. This person's going to be fine. You're not going to kill off Harvey Keitel. You're not going to kill off McConaughey. You'll kill off these lesser actors because they're not well known, or, you know, they've served their purpose. So, oh, man has, I don't know, sent off Torpedo One. That was his job. Oh, he's dead now.
Yeah.
You know, or man has to, Emmett or Tiger, wherever his guy, the guy was, pull the little valve to make sure the U-boat can do something important. Oh, no, he drowns.
Yeah, the air valve, yeah.
I knew he was going to drown because he's not McConaughey or Keitel. Like, there wasn't enough tension. And even then, those characters are so one-dimensional, I don't really care anyway. McConaughey's charismatic. He carries it enough anyway.
Yeah, he does. But
I think there's possibly too many characters in the sub at that point. What happened to the rest of the German crew? We never find out.
They took them off, and they all died on the S-33, I think.
Oh,
you see, like, them loaded into like one more boat as it goes across.
Oh, God, yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. Hang on. Yeah, they do that. Sorry.
I actually do like that sequence where someone just turns around, like, probably should have had a lookout. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Keeping an eye out for anything. But just the way that single torpedo comes out of nowhere is really
reminded
nice.
Reminded me of when they do that, when they're transferring in under siege, when they get attacked. Reminded me of that.
Oh, yeah.
When they're on the U-boat there. That was good. But yeah, it's a little bit long in that end sequence. I think it front ends itself a lot. The first hour was very well done, very punchy, engaging. And then, oh, what do they do now? Because they have to escape. They can't really go anywhere, really. They're like, oh, yeah. We have to get to our own waters and get to, you know, allied airspace. And one of them says, call for an airstrike. And I'm like, for fuck's sake, can I have said that in 1940? And then later on, one of them says air cover. So I'm like, that's much better.
Yeah.
But anyway.
One thing that did annoy me, I think McConaughey says fire throughout the whole film. But shoot. Like, you don't say fire on a
Oh, right.
On a US Navy vessel or boat.
Shoot torpedoes.
Yeah, it's shoot. Because if you shout fire, it means there's a fire.
There's a fire. Okay, that makes sense. You know? Yeah.
I think that's a few navies are like that. But yeah, I was like, yeah.
Like, to me, just the second half is just weak. You know.
Seen a couple of films like that this week. For me, I think the cut to make it PG-13 from R-rated probably hurt it a little bit. Apparently they digitally removed a lot of the blood squibs.
Oh, really?
From that initial firefight in the boarding sequence.
Oh.
John Bon Jovi was supposed to have a very gory decapitation death.
Yeah, I heard that.
But I think he just gets shot. And it's very blink and you miss it. So we were talking before we began recording, Rob was saying, like, I kept thinking John Bon Jovi was the sonar guy or the radio guy.
Yeah. Yeah, like clean, and I can understand why. American man. Like, they all look the same.
Yeah, it's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was not pleased that this film won the vote, I'll be honest. There was a couple of good options in there, but everyone
was,
kind of like
Matt was
vindictively went for this.
I love it. Thank you, FOF fans. I love it. I love that you want us to review these movies that you really want us to review. It's one of the reasons we do it, because as I say every week, or, you know, 9 times out of 10, I go, you can't watch AAA movies every week. You've got to watch the random and the obscure. It's just, this film is just interesting because it's so despised by the history community. I think the general public didn't hate it, but because it made money, obviously. They didn't hate it because it made money. Yeah. But over the years, it's become this little black sheep of the family, of the war film family. We're like, oh, we don't want to play with you anymore. We don't like you. Because you've muddied
It's the fury of the 2000s.
It is, yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, like, it's a very mid film. It's
mediocre. Is the word this week.
It's competently made, great cast, solid cast. But they're not stretched. They're not given anything to do. It dips in the middle, as we've said. There's some genuine moments of tension with some of the depth charging, which was a pretty competently made depth charge sequence, I thought. But then there's some really predictable characterization. There's the guy who second guesses the lieutenant's orders. There's the classic NCO. And then the film really, really heavily signposts everything that's going to happen. Yeah. So the crewman dying, the lieutenant ordering men into situations where they might die. He literally has a conversation with Paxton. And the reason Paxton doesn't recommend him for command is because he's not demonstrated that he's willing to order his men into danger.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, okay, well, someone's going to get ordered into danger then, aren't they?
Yeah.
And then someone talks about like being depth charged, and then they get depth charged. And it's just like, stop signposting every damn thing. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't need to, like, you don't need to spoon feed the audience this much. No.
Yeah. It's very
every like, major dumb. Like thing that happens gets like, oh well, this is gonna happen. Like, yeah, and then well, at the climax of the film, Rob, the climax of the film, literally. He draws out what is going to happen on a piece of paper.
He shows you what's going to happen, yeah.
And I'm like, you don't want to have to draw a diagram to explain the climax of your movie. Like, come on now.
Or if you do that now, the trend is that you show it happening while you're talking about it. So you overdo the trope. And even Keitel has the moment where he's clearly hearkening back to when he told McConaughey about, even if the plan's weird or wrong, you'd still 100% buy into it because the men have to buy into what you're saying. And you can tell him running the numbers in his head like C-3PO in the Millennium Falcon when they're trying to escape, you know, and he's like, we'll do it.
Don't tell me the odds. Don't tell me the odds.
Keitel.
Never tell me the odds, Keitel.
Yeah, never tell me. Yeah, exactly. But it's...
I think perhaps the redeeming feature might have been if the ship had been saved by a British destroyer or a Sutherland.
That might have been fun.
That might have helped because it's like, you managed to sink
out of nowhere and
you managed to sink the ship with that last torpedo, and it's like, oh, okay.
I loved it. I love that cliche that was. We got one shot. I got one. You see, it's the U-boat equivalent of I've got one clip left in Windtalkers.
Yeah, it is truly.
But I thought to maybe end the episode this week. It might be difficult off the top of our heads. People said at the time, oh, you should just make it a British story. And that got me thinking of in 2000, I mean, obviously now we have some very bankable British stars that are in Hollywood. You know, Benedict Cumberbatch, Colin Firths, Gary Oldman's, people like that. And obviously those people were around back in the early thousands. But, you know, I don't know if Oldman or Firth would have done this, but... If you just to cast it at the time for a British cast, I think you might struggle to make a film that would sell in America with British stars.
Yeah, you'd have had to have had a Royal Canadian Navy officer who was played by a really well-known American, or an American who's joined the Royal Navy to like lead it. You would have had to have had that kind of situation, I think.
Yeah, you might have had. Who's the Irish guy who's in? Who was in the Total Recall remake?
Colin Farrell.
Colin Farrell might have been in there at the time.
Yeah.
And you might have got a Gary Oldman in there, but I can't.
Tim Roth,
yeah, might have worked. But even then, Tim Roth really box office at that time.
But recognizable, at least.
Recognizable. See, this is the problem. I think now you would do it, I think, easily.
Bale?
At that 2000. Bale, this is a year before American Psycho.
Yeah.
So, and in that same year, he's a villain in Shaft, and he's not really in it a lot.
He could have been a supporting.
He could have been, but I don't think he'd carry it.
No, he couldn't carry it. Like,
you know, were people in 2000 being like, oh, I'd love to see this U-boat film with the kid out of Empire of the Sun in it?
That's good.
Would they have said that? Not really. I don't think so.
Sean Bean could have been in it. he would be recognizable. Ronin.
Actually, though, Sean P. might have been a shout.
Goldeneye.
Yeah, good point. Pierce Brosnan, maybe.
Timothy Dalton could have been actors. In it as like Bill Paxton's character.
Yeah, but even then, even with that, I still think you struggle to sell it.
Oh, no, it would never be. It would never have made, what was it, like 120
mil? 127 million, it wouldn't have got there.
Yeah, it would never have made that.
No, it wouldn't have got there.
What about now?
Well, now you'd have like Cumberbatch, you could have Daniel Craig, you could have, you know, as a, if you want to put a music star in there, you could have Harry Styles, and he's done a war film. There's, you know, like we're in that second wave of the British invasion, aren't we? Like with Styles and that break in America. So I think now you could do it. And telling the story of HMS Bulldog capturing the Enigma would be interesting.
It would.
But even then, I still think that the British...
As long as they don't do what they did to Operation Mincemeat.
Exactly. Yeah. It just kind of came out, that film, didn't it?
Yeah. Well,
We've yet to crack World War II films. We've had some very good first World War movies, you know, 1917.
Yeah.
We've had Dunkirk, I understand, but that was Nolan. It's still an American production. We've yet to have.
I believe Christopher Nolan has a film out at the moment.
I've not heard about it.
Oppenheimer, I believe it's called.
Oh yeah.
Let us know if an ad rolls with Oppenheimer.
Please, we'd love to. Right there, because we're a war movie pod, so it probably just thinks war.
It's like the one time we can possibly get adverts for an actual war movie.
That's why really we're not movie. Reviewing on the film for reason for reviewing on the pod for reasons. Anyway, so
exactly. Listen to last week's episode and you'll find out why.
Exactly. Don't know what we're talking about. But yeah, I think you, as an industry, we've yet to do a big budget World War II actioner. And I know those movies aren't as well.
Are we gonna get that with Cavill and
that'll be the test.
I don't know.
Yeah, Ungentlemanly Warfare. Maybe that'll be the test. Anyway, that was U571 for this week. Matt, I think we're just calling it a bit mediocre, aren't we?
I think so. I mean, I didn't hate it as much as I thought I was going to hate it. No. It's been a good 15 years since I've seen this film. And I know Rob hasn't seen it since you saw it as a kid.
Yeah, when I was like 7 or 6.
Yeah.
You know.
So, I mean, we went into this pretty fresh. We had the controversy around it and I tried to go into it fairly open-minded and I just sat and watched it in bed.
I poured a pint and noticed an Adidas sneaker about 13 minutes
in. You did.
Which made the edit. So there you go. That's going to be the end of this week, that there's an Adidas sneaker in the movie.
It's okay. It's not awful. It is awful. Depends on
it's not bad, but it's
standpoint,
bad. If you can see above all the controversy and you've got a couple of hours to kill, you can do a lot worse.
Yeah, arguably, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, that's our thoughts for this week. Do join us again next week for another war movie review. Please go over to the website, fightingonfilm.com, where you can find the entire back catalogue of the show. Maybe start from episode 1, work your way up. And if you do, leave us a review on whatever you're listening on. Helps the podcast, helps those algorithms be algorithmy. And we'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.